Broadsheet Radio Network.
Hiya, pals. Have you missed us? A quick FYI that this episode was originally recorded in April 2023. We apologise for the delay, but, you know, sometimes life finds a way and sometimes life gets in the way. Thank you for your patience, and let's get to it. Hiya, pals, welcome back to another episode, in fact, the last episode of this season of Under the Kilt. With me, Adam McNamara.
And me, Natalie Younger, in desperate need of a haircut.
And if you've not been here before, and I'm just doing this to remind myself, mainly, but we are a history podcast, and we like to take a donder down the path of all the lesser worn walks in the country of Scottish history. Stuff that's been hidden under a brick or a docky.
Is that what we're doing here? Thanks for reminding me, Adam. As Adam said, it's thanks to everyone for being patient with us while we got our proverbial ducks in a row for our finale. Everybody just got real busy.
They did.
Can deal with that.
including us and schedules just weren't working out. But what have you been up to? Anything exciting?
Oh, absolutely not. I've just been holding my breath, waiting to return to the Zoom room with you, Adam.
See, I'm not even believing that.
And you see, when I'm nice to you, you don't believe me. But it's okay because I did take a proactive path, donder down the paths of history, so that I could be very prepared today and tell you exactly what is under the kilt. So I've got it right this time.
What is it?
Under the kilt today is a fresh, hand-picked bouquet of bluebells, primrose, and trinflower.
Right. Where are they kept?
Just tucked in a garter belt.
Yeah, okay.
With my hip flask and my Highland dirk.
And your iron brew? Is there an iron brew there? And
yeah, there's probably iron brew down there.
I mean, it's a busy. Well, here you come definitely over the hills.
Yeah, we should really put a bell around my neck.
We don't have to, because under your kilt is just a riot.
And don't forget, under my kilt is a second smaller kilt. I believe that has also been established.
You're like a Russian doll.
It's fine. Is that, that's what's under the kilt today,
no,
right?
No,
but
you know,
native
good guess.
Plants? No? Oh.
No. Today we have an actor who, I mean, I saw when I was at drama school in Blackwatch. And I remember leaving and thinking, that show is incredible. And he was incredible in it. He's also been doing Rome on HBO. He's been in Line of Duty. He's actually been in so many TV credits that we'd probably run out of time for this particular episode. Do you know? but he performs a really popular live one-man show in Edinburgh called A Dram o' History, and it's 2,000 years of Scottish history in 60 minutes. So, I mean, he's a perfect guest.
Yeah.
Everyone listening, all our pals, it is my pleasure to introduce to you Michael Nardone. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
How are you? How are things?
Things are great. Yeah, I can't complain. I'm very excited about doing this. And of course, like you say, you're right at the moment. You're right in the sort of in my kind of right up my roux, as they say, because history is what I'm dealing with every day in my job at the moment. So,
well, tell us more about that then.
Well, I suppose it's kind of like you know as well as me. You know, actors can have fallow periods.
Yes.
And of course, during the pandemic, we all had a fallow period, and sitting around in the house during lockdown, I mean, you know, we're kind of all eating ice cream and watching Marvel movies, but actually that gets a bit boring after a while. And I thought, well, you start to sit around and you start to read, and you know, I've got musical instruments lying around the house, and traditional music of Scotland, and in fact the British Isles and Ireland has been a passion of mine since I was a boy. I was kind of raised up with that in my house, and I sit around mucking around playing my instruments, you know, and I just started to think about some of the tunes and the songs that I learned as a boy, and then I started to think about some of the stories and things that my grandfather told me when I was young, and just ever so slowly it began to just kind of evolve into this idea of maybe doing something live along those lines, because obviously we weren't working. And so when lockdown lifted, I wrote the thing and hawked around Edinburgh, and I put it in a couple of venues, and it's been running for a year. And I've been dashing off and doing bits of telly and little bits of film work here and there, you know, but actually doing the show has pretty much been, you know, it's been my constant, and I'm glad I did it, because it's kind of kept me, it's kept my brain, it's kept me sane, as you know well. Staying sane when you're unemployed is, you know, is a horrendous task, and so you need to be able to flex your muscles and up and use your skill set however you can, and so
Keep them creative, you know. It's
and
like, because it can, you can get into a bit of a hole with it all, can't you? If you're not doing anything,
well, you can just
you need to apply that creativity, otherwise you'll just climb the walls.
you can disappear into a dark place, you know.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, living in Edinburgh is made me realize that Edinburgh is probably one of the most tourist populated cities in Northern Europe. And they all come here for the history, for the architecture and all that stuff. And I'm thinking, as an actor, well, actually, I don't really want to kind of do that thing of rehearsing a play and then putting it on for 3 nights, you know. The town is a sitting duck because of the tourists. And so actually, you gotta employ your skill set in a different way. You gotta wear a different hat. And so we often, as actors, we would maybe look down on the tourism or the leisure industry, and it's a mistake, because these people want to be entertained as well as a theatre-going audience. And so, you know, I just thought, come on, you know, it's a way. If there's going to be a town to be unemployed in, this is the one. So, you know.
Yeah, honestly, just to digress a little bit, when you're in Edinburgh, you can't get away from the history. It's like it's absolutely everywhere. Like when I was there just last week, I was there last week just doing a wee gig, and every time I drive past that castle, it's like that's a massive castle. It's just it reminds you of the history that's in that city.
Yeah, it's actually it's impressive to be like history blind in that city. I'm thinking specifically of our dear friend Grant O'Rourke,
Grant.
who was like, "Oh shit, all of this stuff is right by me."
Yeah, I know Grant. He lives about half a mile away from me, just over there.
Does
Yeah, geez,
he?
just up there.
You should go for wee walks together.
I see him on the bus sometimes, you know.
Grant's right into his history now. I
Yeah.
think he's wanting to maybe like have a little tour bus.
Yeah, we converted him. We converted him into a history fan.
Why not?
Just toss a string, toss like a can and a string over to him, and basically he can remote into the podcast from his place.
Absolutely. I can get him singing.
So, Michael, you're in Edinburgh now, and you lived in London for a while, I assume. But where are you from originally?
So I was born and brought up in Fife, the ancient kingdom of Fife, just across the river to the north of here. So yeah, so I was raised there, and I came to Edinburgh to study. I was here in drama school for 4 years, and I met my wife, and then, of course, like most of us, we flew south and to London, and I was there for 30 years. We raised our kids in London, and they were all educated and universitied down there. After the in the Brexit vote, we decided enough was enough. We left and came back, and it didn't. I never even felt like we'd left. Isn't that weird? When 30 years of your life had passed, but it felt like it hadn't. It's bizarre.
I was only in London for 8 years, but as soon as you got back to Scotland, it just felt so easy. And I had to go back down to London maybe about a month later, and I remember getting off the tube and just being like, I can't believe I spent 8 years here. This is horrible. Like, it was just like so packed, and you know, it's like you do like 22,000 steps a day, even when you're just taking like even when you're taking the trains and stuff. It's just constantly walking.
Yeah, no, I was there last week for a meeting, and you know, this wonderful train ride down the East Coast. It's beautiful, you know, and you know, I left very early morning Edinburgh in a blue sky. It was beautiful. Get to London, the first thing you do when you get off the train is go under the ground. you know. And I thought, oh, fuck's sake, here we go. You know, and you have to navigate all of that and all the people, the crowd, everything. You know, and just suddenly you've forgotten what it was like. But then returning, coming home, arriving at Waverley, and then coming up to this, that view is just like, wow, my God.
And that is the best train journey to London from Edinburgh,
Down the
isn't
east
it?
side here, yes.
Yeah.
It's wonderful because it's you know, it's
It's stunning.
with a number of beautiful, with the countryside to begin with, the number of ancient places that you see on the way. You know, you leave Edinburgh and you pass North Berwick, and you know, and the you know Prestonpans Battlefield, and you pass Berwick upon Tweed and Durham Cathedral, and so on and so on, and York, and as it goes, and you go, it's an amazing little train ride through history itself, from north to
Yeah.
south, you know. Yeah, anyway,
Absolutely.
so that's it. So that's kind of, I'm here now, and yeah, and I do my show to keep myself occupied most days. Today I had three people, three Kentuckians. I had three people from the Bronx, and I had four people from New Delhi in my audience. So that's the kind of vibe, you know. This is the people that are that's what I mean about Edinburgh being people from all over the world are looking for something to do.
Well, and to your point, they're looking for the history, so
Yeah.
it's not. That's what they want. So it's genius, a genius show idea to be like, all right, well, I'm interested in this, you're interested in this,
Yeah.
let's do
Michael, do
it.
you get many Scots coming to see it?
Not many actually. I've had
Yeah.
some to be honest, but not many. No, the ratio from Scots to people from overseas is, you know, it's nothing. It's
Yeah.
you know, most of them are North American. I have a lot of Scandinavians. I had 15 Norwegian men, because I do. I mean, it sounds like very little numbers, but the place I do is a small, very intimate, bespoke little space. It's perfect for the kind of product that I'm delivering, and it's great because they all get whiskey. They just come in, they get, and that's the slight, the kind of gimmick, the play on words, you know, a dram-o history. They get a dram, and then they get like a massive broad paintbrush of history in an hour. And they love it, and it's great. And of course, I sing, I play, I do three or four traditional songs and what have you. And so, you know, and it's all packed into an hour, and it's very, very popular in the town now. It's becoming, you know, it's becoming, but it's great. It's becoming.
I'm gonna have to come and see it. I want to come and see it.
Ah, absolutely. You should come through. Just let me know.
Yeah,
Michael, have you
absolutely.
always been interested in history? Like, has it kind of always been, or did you kind of find a love of history while going stir crazy?
No, you know what it's like. As children, we it doesn't matter if we're brought up in an urban environment or a rural environment. You know, we take for granted what's under our feet. We take for granted the past, the baggage, the history that's there, you know, and it's not until later on that we actually begin to appreciate where we were brought up and how our city evolved, or how your town or the countryside, you know, and you start to get interested in that. But for me, like I mentioned earlier, my grandfather on my mum's dad on my Scottish side, because my dad's side are Italians, right? And my mum's dad is probably the greatest influence on my life. He was a coal miner called Dan Henderson, a brilliant gardener and all that stuff, but he was also full of local knowledge, and of course he was an old romantic. He loved to read westerns, for example. That was his kid, paperback westerns. But he loved legend. You know that great quote from Tolkien, where he says history becomes legend, and then legend becomes myth, to the point that we forget maybe that the myth actually had a root, a solid root somewhere way back. My grandfather loved was interested in all this, and so he used to tell he told us stuff. We were all sat around cross-legged by his fire all the time, listening to him tell us these stories, particularly stories from the place where I grew up in Central Fife. Then, of course, one thing leads to another. You want to know more. And then you realize that Fife has a ridiculously dense history for a small county. Actually, a small kingdom, because, like I said, it's still called the Kingdom of Fife, commonly known as the Kingdom. It's the only kingdom left in the British Isles.
That's right.
So we're kind of proud of that, you know. And so, yeah, so it led me to, over the years, you become an amateur historian and you want to know a bit more. And it's all snippets and bits of stuff, you know, but actually you can put a nice timeline together. It's all the way from the Romans to now, you know.
Well, that's why we started this podcast, of course, because, you know, history wasn't something that at school I was really intrigued with, because it seemed to be very kind of down one particular path. And then I didn't even know, like, and this kind of leans into to yourself, Michael, like, I didn't know there was such a large Scottish-Italian contingency here. Like Tinderbox, one of my favourite coffee shops.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
It was started by Italian immigrants. So, like, it's really. Would you want what? So tell us a bit more about the Italian side of your family.
Well, my grandfather, uh-huh, Giuseppe, arrived here as a small boy. His father, my great grandfather Barbato Nardoni, and his wife Maria Salvata, they landed initially in Lancaster, in the northwest of England, because back then in the late 1800s, early 1900s, Lancaster was still had the Lancaster's built on the river, what's it called now? The Lune, the River Lune, Lune. But it's a very deep tidal river, and Lancaster itself has this amazing quayside. The quayside was constructed to support the arrival of slave ships from the West Indies, you know, with the tobacco and the slaves themselves that they were transporting into Northern England. Mm-hmm. And so it meant it could support ships coming in from elsewhere. And so they ended up, one way or another, disembarking at Lancaster. And Barbato Nardoni, he set up a boarding house. But on the ground floor of the boarding house was a cafe, an ice cream parlor. And they made ice cream, gelato, there. And he would take other Italian families who'd left Italy off the boat, and they would stay in his boarding house, and they would work for him, and they would sell ice cream round about the streets of Lancaster and stuff, until such point where they had enough money to support themselves, he would move them on, and then somebody else would come in. So he was kind of doing this, and in fact, a lot of very interesting people came through that boarding house. For example, do you remember the hotel chain Forte?
Yeah.
Forte. I think they became, or were bought out by Best Western, the Forte chain of hostels. That family came through that boarding house. They worked for Barbato, and they were sent out on their way into the world. And of course, then they became the empire that they became.
Wow.
But yes, and then eventually, when the Fife coalfields opened up, they moved up to Fife. And of course, they had more children and all that stuff. And eventually, most of them either had an ice cream shop, or they were coal miners in Fife. Uh-huh. So my immediate history is coal miners on both sides, on my mum's side and my dad's side. Yeah.
So when you were holed up eating ice cream and watching Netflix during the pandemic, it was part of your heritage.
Listen, I would eat ice cream at any time of the day.
Me too. I was literally just eating ice cream out of the carton before we started recording.
It's kind of like when people say to you, what are your favorite foods? You're always really cautious about what you say, right? Because you think, oh man, I'm going to have to say something ridiculous, like, you know, halloumi and kind of all that shite, you know. And actually, I'm just kind of brazenly honest now. I just go pasta and ice cream. That's for me. Those are. I can't lie. You know,
yeah.
You can't lie about it. And that's probably to do with the fact that I was weaned on this stuff, you know?
Exactly.
You're like, those were our core food groups. It was pasta and ice cream.
I would pasta every day. I would eat it 2-3 times a day. I love it.
Those are also excellent cheat code answers for what your favorite food is, because there's so many different ways to make them.
Yeah.
And there's so many different flavors. And so you can't, like, when people ask, what would you eat for the rest of your life question, I'm always just like, soup. You didn't tell me to pick one.
No.
Soup and ice cream.
You know?
I'll be great when I can't chew my food. When I'm old and I can't chew my food, I'll be set.
Exactly. No teeth and all that stuff.
I'm ready.
So, Michael, have you had to tone down the Fife accent then? Like, because I've got friends from Fife, and when they talk together, I'm right in saying it's the fastest dialect in the UK, isn't it? When they speak together,
yeah.
But because sometimes I can't even understand what they're saying, like when Fifers speak to each other,
the rate of utterance is extreme. I went to a funeral. I drove my mum and my sister, right, up to Montrose to this funeral. I could barely understand what they were talking about in the car. I mean, obviously, I never intended to ever lose my accent when I was down in London. I just thought, well, why would I even attempt that? Because that suddenly I'm not me anymore. I just wanted to always be me. But clearly my accent is completely modified over the years, but that is and like you said before, the swearing involved is unbelievable. Swear words are very important in Fife. They're like kind of they're like punctuation marks. You know, they don't mean anything.
I can get behind that 100%.
Like Fifers use the C word. I mean, and I'm from Dundee as well, so that it's I grew up with it as well. And it's not, and I know that some people get a lot, oh, don't like the C word, blah blah blah. But we used it, and they use it in Fife as well. As it's just what
it's a term of endearment.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not meant in a. You know when it's meant in a horrible way.
Yeah, absolutely. And interestingly enough, the one way that we never used that word ever was to refer to what it actually is. We never ever used that word to describe female genitalia, ever.
Well, do you want, I can take us on a quick side journey, a quick little etymology side journey of something that I recently learned is that cunt is the only word referring to female genitals that isn't in reference to male genitalia. Like it is its own, it is the only, one of the only words that it is what it is. And it's not because, oh God, I want to say that the word vagina actually has its roots as in like a sheath for a sword. So every other word is in reference to inserting another piece inside, okay, except for cunt. So... Huh. It's actually the most independent, if you will, of the terms you could use.
Yeah. And it also means pal.
Yeah, and it also just means good friend.
Precisely.
I just think it's funny that it's a word that is that since like the late 19th century is associated with like misogyny, when it is actually the least misogynistic word for what it means.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So the more you know, that was a little rainbow moment for us.
Twing, cunt.
Oh, hey, let's hit pause for a second to play everybody's favorite game, Adam. Yeah. It's time for Talking Scots.
Yes, I've missed it.
As always, we welcome our producer, Kathleen, on for this bit. Say hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
You did great. 10 points. This show is, of course, all about learning, so Kathleen and I are going to continue to immerse ourselves in the language of Scots. Michael Nardoni has brought us a word that we will immediately know what it is.
Yep.
I'm drunk on confidence.
You're drunk on something.
Michael, what is our word today?
Yod swiver.
Oh, fucking hell.
Is that two words or one? It's one word?
It's one word, but it's in two parts. Yod swiver.
And I'm going to admit this to my American friends that I've never heard this word.
Okay, good now word, remember Michael. The rules, Adam. You don't get to guess.
I don't get to guess.
No.
Oh, okay. I want it.
It's an insult. I'm going with an insult. I have to answer first because otherwise I'll just...
But what insult, Kathleen?
That you're like full of shit. Like that you spew out like you're just making... up lies.
It's funny that that's your guess because my guess is also shit adjacent. My guess was going to be that it is a rural term and that it is a like farming tool, perhaps that you like shoveling shit, and therefore in a colloquial sense could be in a similar situation of used in slang.
Do you know what's great is that I am absolutely on the same page as you guys. So your guesses don't even seem silly. If they are silly, I don't know. But more often than not, I know what the word is. So your guesses are hilarious to me. But these aren't. I'm like, that could be.
Michael, what's her? Is it a noun? Is it an adjective? Oh. Did we nail it?
So it's one word, but it's in two parts. So yod swiver. So the yod part is the noun. The swiver part is the adjective. You could split the word, you know, you probably could, but in this context, it's one.
So the yod is the noun. What was the other part? Is an adjective?
The swiver is the doing word. That's the
the verb then.
Yeah. Verb, sorry, yeah.
So okay. I'm still going to go, oh God, now I don't know, because if yod is a noun.
I I'm going to go ahead and say that it's like another way of saying God damn it, because I think Yod is an alteration of God.
Always got to bring practical thoughts.
It's like deep, isn't it?
Is this blocking? Michael's just shaking his head. He's like, get out.
I'm still just going with it's an insult.
Yeah, it is.
Ah.
So I wanted to bring you a really special word, one that
You've brought a special word, Mike.
Can you use it in a sentence for us?
Of course. Him. Oh, yeah, he. Oh, that old Yod Swiver. Ah, watch him.
He's not a pervert. I'm not going with that. I still think that, yeah, I don't know. I'm going to stick with my original guess.
Cool. That's it locked in.
I mean, okay, yeah.
You fucking roll your eyes.
I'm gonna pivot. Kathleen's locked in. I'm gonna continue to change my mind. I'm just gonna say basically it's like an asshole.
How very base.
Well, I'm trying to think of what noun the Yod could be, and I'm like,
Right.
All right. Lay it on us. I don't think we're getting it.
Yod, right?
Uh-huh.
Is a name that describes it's a horse. It's an old, spent mare, like a nag.
Okay.
Right? The swiver is someone who copulates. I'll let you do the rest.
Oh.
Oh. Oh, so it's a horse fucker.
Horse shagger. A yod swiver is somebody who shags horses.
I love that.
Belter.
Listeners, your homework is to call at least half a dozen people a Yod Swiver before we return.
Absolutely, a Yod Swiver
another season.
Because I was telling my wife Natalie earlier on. She said, "What's it? Have you got a word for them?" And I went, "Well, yeah." And she said, "What is it?" And I told her. And she went, "Can't fucking say that."
I am.
I can and I will.
Belton word. Thank you.
There you are. That was the word.
Perfect.
Back to the show.
But anyway, Michael, we could shoot the shit all night, but why have you come to Under the Kilt? Why are you here?
Because you invited me. So that's I just thought, if you're going to cut to the chase, I'll cut to the chase back. Well, because, yeah, first of all, primarily, yeah, because you knew that I had an interest in Scottish history. You know, actually, it would be nice to talk about it.
Yeah.
So I suppose that's why. And I suppose
excellent.
To promote things like Fife and promote my show.
Excellent.
Are there any kind of bits of Fife history that you specifically wanted to share with us? Like we've talked about how it is the last kingdom.
Yeah. Well, pre-Roman, actually, the kingdom was known as Fib, F-I-B. It's kind of, I suppose, the etymology of the word Fife is Fib. And of course, it was pretty much the eastern seaboard of Scotland was a Pictish kingdom. And of course, Galriada on the west coast was more kind of Brythonic down in the Strathclyde. But of course, it started for me when my grandfather told me the story of about an entire Roman legion that disappeared into the mists in the hills above Loch Oar, right? And of course, this turns out to be the fabled lost eagle of the ninth. You know, there's so much conjecture about what happened to the ninth legion. Well, there's a very, very strong legend that we grew up with right there. So on the banks of Loch Oar. So I was grew up in a town called Ballingarry, right, which lies in the lee of a hill known as Benarty Hill or Dunmore, or as we call it, the Sleeping Giant, because it literally looks like the outline of a colossal human being lying on its back.
Yeah.
And so on the other side of this hill, you have the Vale of Leven. So you have got Loch Leven and Kinross and all that stuff. So on our side, you had Loch Oar, the loch itself, and Loch Oar Village and Ballingarry. These are all small mining towns. But on the north bank of Loch Oar, there is the remains of the ditch work and the earthworks of a Roman marching camp. And this marching camp was substantial because it was a stopping point between when Romans landed at Burnt Island, they would march inland, you know, and halfway between sort of between Burnt Island and sort of Perth, it was Loch Oar. So it was a strategic place to stop for legions on the hoof. Most stuff of supplies and materials is traveling by sea, round and up the Tay, up the Tay towards Perth, or up the Forth and disembarking at Burnt Island and Cramond. So this marching camp at Loch Oar was manned quite permanently manned, but they were being harassed continually by a local tribe called the Horesti. The Horesti are a branch of the Venekoni, who actually are probably the Dundee, the Angus and Dundee sort of Venekonis. But the Horesti are a much smaller kind of sect, and they're based in Fife. And they were continually harassing this fort, this marching camp. And I think it was because there's an amazing thing over there. There's a little village called Scotland Well, right, on the banks of Loch Leven. In this village, there is this artesian well. It's a pure crystal spring that comes from deep in the earth. It's constantly flowing. It's naturally filtered. It's very, very important. There was a kind of like a monastic settlement was built around there, and the red friars who would treat people with the water from this well. But the Romans knew this, and they always trying to get at this fresh water source. But the Horesti were trying to keep them at bay, and so they made a famous night attack on this marching camp, and of course they caused quite a lot of damage. And so reinforcements were sent for from Burnt Island. The legend is, that I grew up with, that the 9th Legion were brought from Burnt Island up to Lochore, and they were sent out over Loch Harran Hill into the Lomond Hills, into the Vale of Leven to find these this Horesti tribe, the people that caused the damage during this night attack. But they were never seen again. So to an 8-year-old boy, right, when you hear that,
yeah,
this is blow your mind. This is a real imagination spinner. I mean, this is the sort of box office smash hit of local legends. Because in my mind, as you start to make pictures and you can see these soldiers marching up Harran Hill into these mists with their banners and the bacchanal and the trumpets and the whole thing, and they vanish into the mist, but they're never seen again. And that plagued me forever, you know, and it still does. And I know that the academics and historians and chroniclers would kind of deny all this and say, no, they never even left York, the 9th Legion. Well, fuck off. As far as I'm they disappeared in the mists at the hills above Lochore.
Yeah.
I'll keep that. So it's this kind of story. But we know the Romans were present in Fife. Anyway, you know, we know they were there. We know they were at Burnt Island. We know about the marching camp. There's a little village in Fife called Ceres. You'll know this, Adam, right? Uh-huh. Ceres, just outside Cooper. Of course, Ceres is she's a Roman fertility goddess of agriculture and the harvest. Uh-huh. And this, you know, that particular part of Fife we know is very arable, but this town is named after this goddess. And there was probably a water source there. The Romans were very good at choosing a local place, a local site, and then renaming it after their own deities. And it's this kind of story as a boy that, you know, that kind of is going, wow, so there's much more to this place than meets the eye, you know. And if you go through the timeline of Fife, you come across some amazing characters.
Like we had Gillian Mannion came on, a TV writer, and she was talking about the Picts. Like she came on and she spoke a lot about the Picts, and she touched on this, but you've went into a bit more detail with regards to the factions involved and what they were doing. And but the ninth, we were speaking about the ninth, we touched on them at one point, and we were just like, I wonder the stuff that you've looked into, do you have any inclination as to where they could have went? Because the ninth were the premium, right? They were like the top of the Roman legions.
They were the ninth. They were the Hispana. They were the famous guys. Yeah. They've been all over. They've been in Judea. They've been in Germania. They've been on the Danube. They've been everywhere. And suddenly, they're in fucking Fife, freezing their bollocks off. You know what I mean? And they're like, oh, fuck.
Getting harassed by Dundonians.
You know what I mean? So yeah, getting harassed by fucking guys from Dundee. So
we've all been there.
to me, they either did one or two things. They either literally vanished in the mist, mysteriously, which is the bit I prefer because I'm the old romantic, or
very Stephen King of you.
Or they get over the other side of the hill and they go, fuck this, come on, let's go. So
they get out of eye line and then just kind of like drop and like shuffle.
Yeah, so they leg it through the mist while nobody's looking. And fuck off.
Yeah. Like, this is our chance. This is our chance to get away.
We just get used.
Yeah.
Every time we go home, they send us out on one of these impossible missions. This is our reward for being good at our jobs. Fuck this. We quit.
Yeah. Who are we chasing? The who? Ah, fuck that. Fifers. Nah. You know?
about a well? They can keep it. We're going.
Fifers, come on. We know about those guys. Listen, there are no bridges into Fife at this point. You know what that means? Ding, 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 ding. We can meet
the, ford the river.
Meet the wife, stroke sister. And the rumors are like, no, no. No, thanks. We're off-ski. So, I don't know. But it's also interesting because around about the same time as all this, remember, this is when the famous Battle of Mons Gropius is supposed to have taken place. Mm-hmm. It's around about the same time. Mm-hmm. It's AD 82, 83, whatever that is. You know, we know about all this through through Tacitus, of course, because he chronicled the career of his father-in-law, the great general Agricola, of course, who made heavy advances into Scotland. And so he, according to Tacitus, he and the legions, they face off against a massed army of the Caledonian Confederacy, right? Led by this one person. And of course, to us, it's important because it's this resistance leader who leads this army against the Romans is the first ever recorded mention of a named person in the history of Scotland. And his name is Calgacus, otherwise known as the Swordsman. And so that's a kind of that's an important historical starting point for us as Scots, because before that, nobody exists until this is the first person that's ever named, recorded. But I find it quite interesting, all of this, you know, because Tacitus was an expert propagandist. He would have everybody believe that the Romans would win this battle of Mons Gropius, right? And of course, Calgacus, he writes, made, you know, the famous speech that Calgacus made. Yeah. They butcher, they ravage, they murder. By the lying name of empire, they make a desert and they call it peace, right? So Tacitus is putting these words into Calgacus's mouth, you see. I was thinking about all this, you know, I was thinking, well, you know, two things. First of all, if this battle had actually taken place, right, and if the Romans did win it, then we can be under no illusion, no debate that Scotland would have been absorbed into the empire, right? It would have, but it wasn't, you know. And yeah, I kind of think, you know, and of course Tacitus, this propagandist, he would have everybody believe that the Romans win every single battle that they were in, even the ones they lost, you know. The good people of Rome don't want to hear that the legions are periodically getting their fucking arses kicked up the Danube or in Gaul or up in, you know, up in Caledonia. And so they have to win everything. So it's a kind of interesting sort of period for us, you know, because we have to rely on testimony of a Roman writer who chronicled the career of Agricola about 30 or 40 years after he died. So,
and who would have absolutely no cause to be biased in the way that he chronicled history. No reason. There'd be no reason for him to spin things in the favor of the Romans.
Nah, exactly. So so it's kind of a, it's I don't know what, you have to be an old romantic to be able to embrace all this and kind of, you know, but it's also, you have to be also realistic, and you know, we've so very easily can just take things like that as an absolute tip. Now, the only reason we know of this guy, Calgacus, is because the Roman wrote him down in a book. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean, you know, but it's still, it gives us a thing to hang on to, you know, because we know the Romans were there, and we know they fought with the Picts and with their guerrilla tactics. And we also know they fucked off because they couldn't beat them. So,
whether or not this actual engagement occurred and whether or not Calgacus was a real person or just a fictitious, convenient foil to pin these words on, it's still interesting from a position of, I didn't know that this was, that Calgacus was like the first named person, like of the quote unquote enemy for the Romans. That in itself is interesting, even if none of it actually happened. It's interesting. It's still a turning point of Roman historian naming the enemy instead of just basically humanizing the enemy instead of just being like,
no,
they're these angry hordes of people. And they,
you know, and he gives us, you know, he gives Calgacus an amazing speech against the Romans.
Mm-hmm.
They butcher, they plunder, they ravage. And they do it in the lying name of an empire. They call make a desert and they call it peace. So the Roman is actually giving, you know, he's giving the
he's saying some things that he might want to say about Rome, but he can't say it, so he's just putting
it to somebody else. Exactly.
Yeah, he's like, I didn't say it; it was this guy.
No. Nothing to do with me.
If I think that he maybe made some good points, then that's just coincidence.
Yeah.
So
someone should write this down, though.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. You know, and of course, he mentions this famous battle of Mons Gropius, you know. And, I mean, this guy, historians and archaeologists, they've spent lifetimes fucking traipsing around the east coast of Scotland looking for a suitable site that might have been, you know, and you get all this, well, no, I think it was Aberdeenshire. And they go, no, it was so-and-so in Angus, you know, and other guys are going, no, it was the Lomond Hills in Fife. Actually, he fucking probably made it up.
Mm-hmm.
Because... You know, they're going, well, you know, Gropius sounds a bit like Grampians. Yeah, but come on, it wasn't called the Grampians, you know, in 1883.
Yeah.
Fuck's sake. So there's all of this fun, you know, that you can have around all this. And I sort of admire all the guys really. It's like, I don't know if you watch that program, Ancient Aliens, right? Those guys who work on that program, Ancient Aliens, truly believe beyond doubt that we are the product of, you know, of early aliens coming to Earth and all that sort of stuff. And I kind of think, well, you know, I don't know. I admire them because they are so convicted. They're so convicted.
Yeah.
And it's the same with these guys, these historians. They're convicted that this place exists and I will find it. I will prove that Mons Gropius is that whatever.
It's interesting. Was because I just did a Google and I saw that. I was like, who was the emperor during... when Tacitus would have been spinning this yarn. Was it Domitian? Is that who... I think that's who the emperor was when he...
Was that who was that? To be honest, I'm not actually certain. You mean...
I think it was from the kind of timeline that I looked up, which is interesting because it's... You would think that if Tacitus invented this and put... And if it was suspected that he invented this at the time and he therefore wrote that negative speech about the empire himself, that he would have been like punished in some way, but he was not. He was awarded honors, which is also interesting if you know anything about Emperor Domitian, because that guy was a dark, macabre motherfucker.
Absolutely.
He would throw parties. We did a Halloween episode, like a scary history episode on him on our sister podcast, Shared History. He would throw parties. He would invite his guests, and the party would be like funeral themed. So instead of like your place card at your spot on the table just being your name, it would be like a legit tombstone. It would be a headstone with your name on it. So everyone in his court was always paranoid there that they were going to be like poisoned at all of his parties, but they had to go to his parties because he was the emperor. Dude was wild.
Yeah.
Dude was goth as fuck.
Yeah, no, these guys are out of control.
So if he thought that Tacitus made this up, if he had any doubts about Tacitus would have been murdered.
Ah, for sure. He
would have been removed from the...
But of course, you know, if the fact that they had to build two walls, right, not just one, fucking two, to deal with this problem. And the dealing with the problem was essentially just not dealing with it. Build a wall and leave them in there. You know, but of course...
I'd build two walls to keep Adam out, so that makes sense.
You know,
I'm a good climber.
Just pop over the wall. The wall's not tall enough. It's just doing a Wilson from Home Alone or Home Improvement.
But you know, but you're kind of getting into the Picts are themselves are an interesting because they're so mysterious because we actually know next to nothing about them because there's no existing language that they left us. You know, markings on stones is pretty much what the remnants of those guys, you know. And of course, Fife is like Angus. Is riddled with this stuff. There are ancient sites everywhere, you know, and Fife had its part to play further down the line.
Oh, can we just stop a minute and
because
it's been a while, right, since we last recorded. So I like to think that at least an hour a day you've been working on your Scottish accent.
I mean, I've watched Miss Scarlet and the Duke, and I paid a lot of attention to our pal Stuart, and I've been watching All Creatures Great and Small, which also has...
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay, but have you been practicing?
Oh, absolutely not. I was really hoping that you had forgotten about this.
Oh, okay, well, I'm kind of glad, because that makes this next bit a little bit funny.
Kathleen, do you have a line for me today? Something normal and easy to do, I'm sure.
I mean, it's shorter.
I'll take it.
So today's quote is coming from the 1998 film All I Wanna Do, and the quote is, up your Ziggy with a wah-wah brush. Great. And I just want to hear you say all those things in your best
in a perfect
brogue.
In a perfect Scottish brogue. Okay.
All ears.
Up your Ziggy with a wah-wah brush.
You rolled that. You were rolling that R.
I really had to roll into them. I could give you another one. I feel like I should sound angrier doing this.
Yeah, it's always better when you're angry.
Maybe I'll give Kathleen what she really wants, which is an ugh. Up your Ziggy with a wah wah brush.
There we go.
Ugh, I.
So bad. This is when we go to our guest.
And he has Michael. No notes.
No notes.
What did you think?
That's great. I love it. Try be a little bit more monosyllabic. Like, imagine you're from Kirkcaldy, right? And Fife, and do it that way. So try not to be so colourful with it.
Try not to be so bad.
Put it down in the back of the
throat. Do it better.
Up your Ziggy with a wawa brush.
You're Irish.
I made it more colourful and a little Irish.
A little leprechaun.
Yeah, we've jumped over to Ireland.
The Irish sea there.
Look, I was trying to channel Tyler Collins doing Fife.
Tyler is probably so offended right now.
Well, he has the most colourful Fife accent.
But it's a good Fife accent.
Yeah.
That's
the difference. Yeah.
I like it when it's longer because it deviates through lots of different accents.
Yeah, Adam likes to when
so
it goes
now
a little
Russian. So now we're dissing the quote. Is that what you're saying? Now we're coming for the quote. You can't come for the quote.
Listen, oh, I think I nailed it. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Up your Ziggy with a wawa brush.
That was actually all right.
That was no bad.
It's always fine if I go McGonagall.
Yeah.
That was good because you slowed it down a little bit. See, I think you're rushing it to get through it, but slow it down.
Yeah.
And really sort of chew it around, you know. Yeah.
You say it, Adam.
Up your Ziggy with a wawa brush.
Why do you always have to make it sound sexual, though? Everything with that voice is just like, up your Ziggy.
That's just Adam's voice.
I just lean into the mic. That's all I do. Well, anyway, nice. Nice. You just keep working away on that.
Yeah, I'll get it one of these days. We've got plenty of time. All right, that's enough bullying of Natalie. Back to the show, where we'll probably still be bullying me.
Actually, here's an interesting one. I do this with our Ouija friends, right? Because I asked them about Saint Mungo, the founder of Glasgow, the patron saint of Glasgow, which everybody's very proud of. Quite rightly, they should be. But I kind of love pointing out that he's actually a fifer. You know, they go, "Ah, the fuck are you on about?" You know, and I love this little kind of fact that Saint Mungo was born in Fife. He was called Kentigern. That was his original name, and he was raised up in Cúras, on the south coast of Fife there, at the sort of ancient town of Cúras, where there was an abbey. And of course, he was raised by Saint Serf, and he was sent off when he came of age. He was sent off to be a missionary, and he was sent to a great river on the west because there were warring tribes that needed to be unified and brought together. And so Kentigern was given this task. And so he went over to this great river, and he made a settlement, a mission house, if you like. And he spoke to all these tribes around there, and he did, in fact, talk them down and talk them into unification, into peace. And they gave him a name, and the name he gave him is from the old Brythonic language of Munkau, right, which means man of the people. Of course, it becomes Mungo, and the place that he founds his mission center becomes known as Clas in the Brythonic language, Clascow, meaning place of the people. And the river Clyde itself is a Brythonic name, Clwyd. It's got that sort of, you know, that kind of what we know now is that kind of Welsh kind of ring about it. So there's another little thing about Fife. And talking of Saint Serf, here's a nice one if you like your romance and your mythology. He was sent over to the town of Dunning Glen, over the hill in Strathearn, to go and chase away a dragon, of all things. great. I mean, imagine you get all that stuff when you're a boy. I'm like, ah, this is great.
Yeah. Michael, I'm sitting here going like that.
Yeah.
Just like sitting listening to you. Just like...
Adam has regressed about 30 years.
But it goes on, you know, and of course the Fife and Strathairn has a big part to play in the unification of, you know, the Scots from Ireland and the Picts during the arranged marriage, which essentially is the formation of Scotland, right? And of course, Forteviot being the Pictish palace at Forteviot was a Pictish centre in on Strathairn, just up the road, not actually in Fife, just outside, near Bridgeavern up there. There are some brilliant characters out of Fife. What about this one? Gruach. You ever heard of that name? Gruach.
Gruach.
Oh.
Gruach. No? Gruach was Queen Gruach. Her husband was Macbeth, King Macbeth, the real guy. Not the fictitious guy from the Elizabethan fantasy. The real guy. She was his wife, Gruach. Now, she had lands in Fife, and she was a very generous woman. In fact, they were well known for their benevolence, these pair. And she gave lands to the monks at Lochleven, St. Serf Island. They were all her lands that she donated. Just outside the village where I grew up, there's a place called Gruach's Well. Now, I knew this place as a child. Gruach's Well, it meant fuck all to me, right? Gruach, it didn't, you know, it just didn't, it didn't mean anything. It's not until later on you go, Gruach, wait a minute. These were her lands. These were her ancestral lands, you know, that she inherited through the matrilineal line. So she had a claim on the royal house of Scotland herself. And of course, it's a great story.
Also a great name, Gruach.
Yeah.
Gruach.
Yeah.
Gruach. You know, they traveled on this epic pilgrimage to Rome in the year 1050, and they were well known because they scattered so much money throughout the streets of Rome, you know. And one eyewitness, there's a quote that it was like giving seeds to the poor. And I love the story that when they were in Rome, they met with King Canute, who was the king of England, Norway, and pretty much Denmark at the time. He was the main guy in Europe. And they met with Macbeth, and they had these discussions on their relations between the kingdoms, I suppose. And I was thinking, what? Fucking what? Macbeth and King Canute having like a wee grappa on our holidays, visiting the Pope. Fucking brilliant. So, and Queen Gruach behind the scenes, probably just, you know.
Yeah, I want to adapt that. I want to see that written as almost like a buddy comedy, like a buddy travel
I tell
comedy.
you, I would love it. It's a great idea, you know. I would love that, you know. He was a pretty cool guy, Macbeth, you know, the real guy. And sadly for us, you know, he within 10 years pretty much of the first production of Shakespeare's play, the name of Good King Macbeth pretty much vanishes from history, you know. We have to,
Wow.
you know, and it's been up to people like in fact, the Fife historian Fiona Watson. She's an eminent historian in Scotland. She said it best, actually. She said this: "It is impossible to exaggerate the injustice that history has inflicted upon this man," because he was so demonized by Shakespeare.
Wow.
I know, it's amazing.
Listen, that must have happened throughout history, because I can't remember the guy's name. He was from, I think he was one from Oban, or he was from Scotland anyway, and he was one of the first to get over like the North Pole, or I think it was the North Pole, or there was some like crazy mad difficult walk. He managed to do it first, and then he found this armada who had resulted in cannibalism and stuff, and when he went back, he'd said, "Listen, I found that armada, and they've all eaten each other," and the you know, the powers that be at the time in England were like, "That'll never come out, that story. You'll never tell that." So they employed. I might be hacking the story to death, but they employed Charles Dickens to write about him in the paper and destroy him, and so he went from being like held up as this guy, and then they just destroyed him. And Charles Dickens was used
Amazing.
to do that.
It's unbelievable, you know. And of course, all that a playwright or a dramatist is looking for is a little bit of something to go, "Oh, I'm going to have that," you know.
Yeah.
And the idea that after the death of Queen Elizabeth, this is when Shakespeare, of course, he's alive. He's Elizabethan. You know, he gets the news. He hears that they are about to get a new king in England. the guy's already a king in Scotland, right? You know, but of course, what's really interesting about this guy is that King James the Sixth, of course, has this fucking twisted, weird, twisted addiction to brutally torturing and burning innocent women and some men for the crime of witchcraft. So it makes sense to me. So Shakespeare's kind of like, he's hearing all this and he's thinking, fucking great. I mean, because what better inspiration does he need to write a play about a Scottish king who is obsessed with witches than a fucking Scottish king who is obsessed with witches? Then all he has to do is choose somebody. So he goes, all right, well, what about that guy there? That weird, that this Macbeth fellow, you know, this 11th century Pictish guy. I'll have him and I'll have him do all this. And then you get to by 1610 or whatever it is, Macbeth, the real guy, his reputation is fucked. It's unbelievable. So, you know, by a dodgy geezer from Warwick. It's fascinating. And then people spend the next 500 years trying to recover the guy's good name.
It's really just a lesson for the three of us as writers, to be a little bit more thoughtful when we're choosing topics. And also just a lesson for everyone that like Shakespeare and Dickens were like the kings of accidental smear campaigns.
Absolutely.
Propagandists.
Yeah. It's almost like that was the whole point.
No, I find the whole thing kind of fascinating.
Is there, Michael, is there something from your show that you hear most often from audience members that they were like taken aback by or shocked to learn or had always heard it differently or something?
Oh, well, you see, I avoid certain things in my show. I avoid Robert the Bruce. He doesn't even get fucking mentioned. William Wallace doesn't get mentioned. All the main guys, I avoid them because actually there's much more interesting stuff to be had. Like, you know, I mean, I talk about the ancient prehistory of Scotland, you know, and the mythology and giants and all that stuff, and you know, and it's the fact that we are, you know, I say in my show that I talk about legends and myths and how we've got this amazing, we're one of the richest collections of folk tales in all of Europe, and so we have this amazing kind of this thing called the oral tradition where information is passed down through generations, and that's why we have legends of shapeshifters and, you know, and all that, and wraiths and sort of all these kind of weird and wonderful kind of creatures that live in our fucking lochs and seas and haunt mountains and all that. And I say that actually superstition is probably the one constant streak in our psyche here, because magic is important to us. We would never say that, you know. You think, oh my God, I'm like, yes, I believe in magic. It's not that, but you're believing in the idea of, you know, of a thing, and it keeps us kind of, it's what kind of, it keeps our passion going for our stuff. That's why superstition played a big part when we chose our national animal, for Christ's sake, right? And people go, my God, you know, because I get a lot of Americans, right? And they go, why would you choose a unicorn? And I go, well, why would you have a regular animal like a dog or a rabbit or a bird as your national animal when you can literally have a creature of magic? And also, you can't tame a unicorn, you know, unless, according to legend, you are a virgin. So,
And that's another episode.
and there'll be no taming of unicorns tonight. So, you know, I kind of people love this idea, this fixation of the kind of history. But there's other things I drop in, you know. I kind of tell people, we talk about whiskey quite a lot, and then I say to them, yeah, well, look, you know, whiskey, you know, we also drank another load of stuff, you know, which was much more popular than whiskey, this stuff called claret, right? And they go, oh my God, what's that? And I go, well, you have to explain that it's a collective name that describes all of the red wine that's produced in the region of Bordeaux, right? And they go, well, why would you have that here? And it's a chance to explain that actually Scotland is, I suppose, in the early Middle Ages, a very successful trading nation and had been for a long time. You know, it was a highly developed, it was a very sophisticated Western European country. And of course, we have to deal with this medieval perception that Scotland is some inhospitable backwater at the edge of the world, you know, that's inhabited by hairy arsed bastards, you know.
I mean, you said
And of course, and you know, and you go, because it's completely so wrong, it's utterly ridiculous. And so I kind of do this thing, I t do this tie-in with the claret about how obsessed we were with this stuff, because King Alexander III of Scotland, he is such a prodigious claret drinker that by the year 1286, right, 1286, Alexander III owed one Gascon wine merchant the eye-watering sum of 1.7 million pounds, right? In 1286, right? That's one man's bar tab.
How do you run that up?
Wait, I love doing conversions.
It's an astonishing sum of money.
The inflation calculator won't even go back that far.
I think it's somebody, what my mate Alex McSherry, he would try to work it out for me. He thought it's roughly about 1.7 billion in today's monetary terms, right? That's what he was drinking. And of course, you know, I have a bit of a laugh about it because I sort of say, well, you know, he managed to avoid his debts by playing a weird old Scottish trick of dying. So
power move.
But here's the best thing, and this is the truth about Alexander III, because he was a known drinker. So now, by the way, he was a great guy. You know, he's the guy that finally expelled the Vikings from Scotland. He is also known for being the first ever recorded case of death by drunk driving, because on a very sinister, stormy night, he's on a horseback and he's pissed up. He's full of red wine. It's 50 mile an hour winds. It's horizontal rain. And he's charging along the coast of southern Fife with his entourage through the storm. They're trying to get to the royal residency at Kinghorn because it's Queen Yolanda's birthday. And he's so fucking drunk that he's not in full control of his vehicle. And he gets a bit too close to the edge. And the king and his mount, they both crash to their deaths far on the rocks, far below. That's how King Alexander III died. Or was he pushed? Who knows? So this is, it's another kind of, for me, this is another legend that I grew up with. You know, you can go and see the monument on the cliffs over there where he fell off and all that sort of stuff. It's,
fell off with air quote.
It's a real Humpty Dumpty situation,
yeah,
going.
Exactly. And it's things like that. And the silly little things that, you know, that I kind of, you could wax on all day about fucking Robert the Bruce and spiders and all that stuff. But actually, why? So there's loads of other little nuggets, stuff, you know, that you would never normally ever hear on a history tour or on some guided walking tour or something. So
that's amazing.
Well, Michael, we have listeners from all over. And also, I feel like if Adam and I have proved anything with our guests on this podcast, it's that more Scots should see your show, because
indeed,
most of our guests are like, I'm Scottish and I didn't know any of this before I looked it up to be a guest on this episode, or I just learned it. So plenty to learn. Where can people find out more about A Drama History?
A Drama History, it's you can look on the website of The Lost Close, which is the venue that I perform. It's a very old venue in right in the heart of Old Town of Edinburgh, or you can book it through my company website, which is edinburghstorytellers@co.uk, or any information on our socials at storyedin.
And we will also link to all of that good stuff in the show notes below. We'll also have plenty of visual aids, if only just to show off the coat of arms of the Kingdom of Fife, because speaking about unicorns, we got a lion and a unicorn.
Yeah, the lion and the unicorn, that's right. And a thane, the Thane of Fife.
Excellent. I'm definitely going to come and see your show, man. Definitely.
You should.
Yeah.
And there's whiskey.
Exactly. I meant to ask, what whiskey?
Well, you have a choice.
Oh. Is there a Smoky Peaty number?
There's a Smoky Peaty number. There's a Northeast. There's an Argyle, a Campbelltown. There's a Speyside. So you've got a choice here, depending on,
lovely,
on your palate.
Well, now I'm thirsty.
It's interesting you mentioned the Smoky Peaty numbers from Isla, all that stuff, because some people go, my God, it's, one American woman said, my God, it smells like a farmyard. And I was like, it made me laugh like fuck, you know, because I was, because it is, it's so like, wah. But he likes it.
Yeah, fucking right. It's right up my street.
Adam does conduct himself like a barnyard animal. So
that's true. That's true.
It makes sense. It makes sense. Yeah, it's just a little taste of home. Everyone, you can find all that good information below in the show notes. This has been our season two finale episode. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
It's been phenomenal. Thank you so much, man.
Thanks for having me. It's been a delight. Yeah, I loved it.
We'll see you next season, question mark?
Fingers
Until
crossed.
Then.
Yeah.
As always.
Stay breezy. This episode of Under the Kilt was produced by Kathleen Mueller-Mason and edited, at long last, by Natalie Younger. Original theme by Tyler Collins, a.k.a. 2 Meter Man. Additional music by Gareth Spin. Original art by Sarah Cruz. Thank you again to our guest, Michael Nardone, and to all our listeners for your patience on this long-awaited finale. See you soon, and stay breezy.